Welcome to our third annual Writers Symposium by the Sea at Point Loma Nazarene College, sponsored in part by the Society of Professional Journalists in San Diego. I'm Dean Nelson, Professor of Journalism at Point Loma Nazarene College, and with us tonight is Anne Lamott, fiction writer, nonfiction writer, whose books include Hard Laughter, Joe Jones, Rosie, All New People, Operating Instructions, the wildly entertaining and funny Bird by Bird, and instructional book. Crooked Little Heart is her most recent book, a sequel to Rosie. And we are delighted you're here. Welcome.
Thank you.
For those of you who have been to our writer's symposiums before and who have seen these on television, I just want them to know that we have tried for 3 years to have you as one of our guests here, and you keep turning us down, and for whatever reason you didn't this time. And we're delighted to have you here. Here's how I'd like to begin. I'd like to focus as much on some of the things you've written and see if you've changed your view of things since you began publishing things, for instance, in Hard Laughter. Your books have, I find, the most interesting characters, but they're all tied together by fear and emptiness and loss and pain, and yet I'm curious as to how you make these characters who are full of that also so buoyant and fellowshipping with one another, and they seem to have even some hope about them during these painful lives they lead. How do you do that?
Oh God, I don't know. It just sounds so wonderful to be able to do that, but I think that that what you've just described sounds to me like most of the people I'm close to, that they are people who have had a lot of pain and who have survived a lot and who are aware of a lot of darkness pressing in all around them as they go through their lives, and yet who are nurtured and enlivened by simple human love. Those that are not people of faith, and especially in the earlier books when I was still a secular writer. And
What does that mean?
Well, I mean, the first three books I wrote, I was drunk for, and and I believed in God in a kind of ecumenical, let's not get too specific here and lose our minds kind of way. And then the next four books, from All New People on, I was A, sober, and B, a converted Christian. So there are characters in the two novels since I got sober and converted, although I converted drunk, and so that's another story. But there are characters who are people of Christian faith. But in the first three books, there are people who I just think have really ordinary human lives, which to me means there's a lot of loneliness, there's a lot of disappointment, there's a lot of hope that certain things might pan out and fill up those holes that are inside, I think, all of us, and that usually people are trying very, very hard to stuff full of achievement or reward or finances or romances or whatever answers, and that just get bigger and bigger the more you stuff into them. But these are all books about people that are in community, because that's all I know. That's what's kept me alive, was the love of really great people. And so it's probably, if you had to pick a theme, what you just described is the theme I write about, mm-hmm. How people stay alive, how people survive, how people don't, how, you know, it's like the last paragraph of Bird by Bird, where it talks about being on that kind of rickety ship in a really bad storm at sea, that if your heart is open and you're trying to be a person of love and connection, then you get everybody singing.
Right.
And you transform it into something that's much, much less chilling and hopeless.
Well, and you do that with All New People, too, where there's a scene where she is swimming, and it is how the book ends, and she just feels like she's being supported and maybe buoyed a little.
In All New People?
Do I have the book wrong?
I'm not sure I've ever actually read it.
What?
I don't remember that. I remember the end of All New People being up at the church, the little white church on the hill, and the father has died, and they're picking wildflowers. She's with her mother.
Well, this is probably a book I read by somebody else then.
Probably.
Maybe when we couldn't get you in previous years. Somebody I interviewed then. I want to know if you've changed at all. I think you've sort of hinted at this already, but if you've changed at all in your view of the world from when you were riding drunk to when you're riding now, your view of humanity, of relationships, of why we're on this planet. For instance, you have in Hard Laughter a character who says to another, "You'd be surprised what humans go through. Tragedy, pain, loss, fear, dying. And you will get through whatever happens." But then the next character says, "But you might not."
Oh, no, but the character says, "But you might not," to the father who says it because he has a brain tumor.
Right.
Right, okay.
Okay, but if we look at the broader meaning, he could also be saying, "None of us might."
Right.
Right? And then you've got another one also from Hard Laughter that says, now this is the narrator talking, "There are the thoughts that, these are the thoughts I am left with, that romance is stupid and sometimes worth it, that fellowship is risky and always worth it, and that I am ridiculous and I am not." Now, has your view of things changed from that?
Is that from Hard Laughter?
Uh-huh. Did you read that one?
No.
Yeah, okay. So I could really be saying anything I'd
care
to
you could,
at this point.
This could all be Danielle Steele. I'm going, oh, she, she's good. No, everything changes when you convert because suddenly you're not entirely insane and all alone and without a guiding light. But that when I wrote that book, I was in my early 20s, and my father, who I couldn't live without, was dying of brain cancer. And I was writing it partly as a love letter to him and to my two brothers, John and Steve, who were going through this experience with us, and I mean, all as a family. And so I basically believe all those things you read, but I believe so much more now that I've gotten sober. I've also survived a couple of unsurvivable losses. You know, my best friend died a few years ago too, and I think I have that that wisdom that comes from being tired and middle-aged, you know, where it's the wisdom that comes from caring a lot less about a lot more things, you know. It's
right.
It's sort of like being in the airplane. When you're 23, which is how old I was when I started Hard Laughter, I was 25 when my dad died, you've just got all this stuff in the airplane, and you think it's all incredibly important, and then people start to die because that it's like welcome to the monkey houses. Vonnegut put it, and that we're these old cars we're driving around, that our bodies do break down, and of course I'm banking on the fact of eternity, but I will leave the earth in, you know, at the current address that I'm living at, and my body will die, but having survived a lot and having been transformed by a lot, and having watched God do a lot of alchemy with all that stuff that you describe, a loss and disappointment and bad romance and, you know, shattered dreams and all that, it's like you get on that plane and you go, gee, isn't it interesting, this box that I've been lugging around, I could care less about it anymore.
Huh.
It actually doesn't matter. I mean, you toss it off because you want to fly a little lighter and a little lighter. And I think also, I'll be 44 in April, and I really had a feeling that I knew a great deal more when I was 25. I thought I had things kind of figured out, you know, and now I feel like, whoa. You know? It was funny, I was teaching a couple years ago, and I was meeting Sam's babysitter at this place where I was teaching, and Sam said, "Are your students going to be famous?" And I said, "No, probably not. In fact, mostly they won't get published." He said, "Why do they write?" And I said, "Good question."
Right.
And I said, "They write because they're living these very intense human lives and they're trying to make sense of it. They're trying to be undefeated by things that are very confusing and disappointing for them sometimes. And they just want to understand life. They want to understand who they are and why it matters that they live really fully." And he said, "Well," you know, he was 40 pounds at the time. He said, "I understand life." And I said, "Isn't that wonderful?" And I said, "What do you understand?" He said, "Pretty good, some problems." And I thought, well, that about says it.
Guy could be a theologian.
Right.
All right, now you've mentioned a number of things here. With the loss of the people who are so close to you in your life, you have also written about, in just some essays and some magazine things, about the importance of grief. Mm-hmm. And that one of the things that that you wanted to do in Crooked Little Heart was to let those characters from Rosie finally grieve, mm-hmm. give them the permission to grieve. Mm-hmm. Why is grief the way you understand it now? How is that different from how you understood it before? Why is it so important?
Well, before, which is to say probably in my 20s and most of my 30s, I was going along with the great palace lie that grief was to be gotten over as quickly as possible, hmm. and that all of these people around me were having terrible losses and were bucking up and having short periods of grief and getting on with life with a certain amount of dignity. And I was led to believe, certainly, I come from my father's father was a Presbyterian missionary, and that's why they call Presbyterians God's frozen people. You know, it's an old joke. And I grew up in a tradition where I never saw, where my father had never seen his father cry. Huh. And he'd never seen his mother cry. There are missionaries in Japan. I never saw my father cry. I saw my mother cry twice or three times. She's English. I'm in a 12-step recovery program for children of the English. But so on both sides, I had the English who were like the Monty Python characters. I mean, no offense to the English people here. And then I had the Presbyterians. I mean, no offense to Presbyterians here. I'm a Presbyterian. But I grew up being told that you don't cry, that you cry a little bit, that you get over it.
Right.
That everyone's dealing with it, that you do the best you can, and that anything else is sort of self-indulgent. It's certainly inefficient. And especially, I think, maybe for women, it so throws the mobile off balance when a woman just stops and says, you know what, I'm actually too sad to do another load of laundry.
Right.
And I'm too
right.
sad to make you any dinner. There's lots of food in the kitchen. Does anyone know where that is? Can I see a show of hands? You know, and it's very, very deeply inconvenient when the person who functions as the hub of a family in the caregiving sense has to stop. And I had always been like a flight attendant for my family. I mean, my mother was a black belt codependent, and I grew up to be one too. And like this geisha girl, and I was valued by how much use I could be to everyone else. I helped
right.
everybody else process their stuff. I distracted everybody else when they felt too sad. What you did if somebody was sad was you distracted them. Go get their mind off of it, right? Take them, say, oh, get your mind off of it. Oh, you know. And you just see people getting crazier and crazier
right.
and trying to work harder and more feverishly. And I came to feel when my best friend got sick when I was 37 that we were, as a people, moving forward in a very isometrically tight way because we could feel the abyss opening at our heels.
Right.
And we thought if we stopped producing, nurturing, co-ing, laundering, and enabling the entire world to stuff down this our real reaction, that the abyss would open up and swallow us. And I came to feel that it was only the grief and the crying that was going to give us ourselves back. And that we were like dried gardens until then. That if we began to cry, it was going to wash out years of calcified, stuffed down feelings. And that if we began to cry, it would water the ground at our feet. And Christianity is totally the wettest religion imaginable. It's all wetness. It's all baptism. It's all ye who thirst has come to the water. It's all about being wet. It's about being cleansed. It's about feeling that all the world has to offer is going to lead you ultimately to being very dehydrated spiritually, you know?
So was writing Crooked Little Heart a way to grieve?
I wrote a piece that's on grief when my friend died.
Mm-hmm.
And curiously, I found a Club Med. I'm like the world's worst traveler. Probably I didn't
you
come
went to
here.
You went to Club Med to grieve?
I didn't know I was going to Club Med to grieve. I thought I was going to Club Med to get my mind off of it. And I got to Club Med, and I could not stay one step ahead of it anymore.
Huh.
And I started to cry, and it was scary because I could see that I wasn't going to be able to stop crying. And at Club Med, I mean, a single tear, it's like, well, you're ruining this for all of us, you know? There's 1,200 people here, and you're ruining it for all of us, Mrs. Unhappy Face. You know, go to your room. You grieve in private. You grieve in private, and you put a nice face on, and when you've cried for a bit, you splash cold water on your face, and you reapply some makeup, and you go back out there, and you become a flight attendant. And I went to Club Med, and I started crying, and I couldn't stop. And I came home from Club Med, and I wasn't going around just sobbing all the time, but I had stopped pretending that I'd never cried about my dad's death. I'd sobbed about my dad's death. I was a drunk. You know, cried about this dog we had that died when I was 12. I go to bars, we go, oh, don't get her started on the dog or her dad, you know. And I cry and I cry and I cry. But I didn't cry sober, and I didn't cry holding space for myself to connect with these huge amputations that had happened to me when I was young, when I was 25. And, you know, 23, the world came to an end. By 24, I was tending to my father as if he was an infant. I was too young to do that. My younger brother was 19. He was too young to do that.
Right.
When I was 37, I did it with my best friend for 2 years, and I had to stop pretending that it hadn't just about killed me. And so I wanted to write a book that said, in effect, these people found their way home by insisting on the right to feel what they felt and to know what they know, that it really hurts to be alive, to be human.
If it hurts so much, doesn't writing about it hurt even more?
No. It often is like cleaning debris away off of a lot. It helps me find out what it is I actually think about it, what I actually know. It helps me capsulize some of it. It helps me find people that can act out the drama of humankind, you know, which is about birth, and it's about death, and it's about romance, and it's about relationship, and it's about children, and it's all, I'm an incredibly happy person. I may be getting so happy that I may have crossed over into some sort of form of mental illness, but I don't feel that life is all sad, but you know, what I really understand historically about Jesus, which has been very important to me in Bird by Bird and in Crooked Little Heart, and certainly these pieces I'm writing on faith, is that a lot of us grew up in houses where if the dad or even the mom, was sad or feeling the gravity of and preciousness of a human life and of a human life lost or about to be lost, what everyone else did was start to pump that person out of it. This tremendous amount of energy went into pumping them out, changing their reality, getting them to have different thoughts about it, putting a better spin on it. And what Jesus said was, I ain't going to do that. You know, no one is going to pump me off of the cross, because that's not what it's about. What it's about is a willingness. What it's about is surrender. What it's about is this absolute trust that if I let go, I will be caught. You know, and instead of this kind of flimsy holding on and feeling the safety, but the stress of holding on, he just let go. And, you know, and so I want it. So when I write about it, it's not because I feel like life is such a burden or that all these characters' lives are really so awful. I feel that the pain that people survive gives them truth about who they are and why they're here. Mm-hmm. And it teaches them how we are to live. That usually in my books, because I'm this way, I mean, almost all the characters are some facet of myself.
Sure.
Usually where they get stuck is thinking that they can, A, think their way out of a very difficult situation, which, you know, has been the story of my life, is thinking I'm going to heal a sick mind with this sick mind, you know, and I'm going to sit there like this, overthinking things if I can think my way out. And the other thing is thinking that it's like, pull up the ladder, I got mine, you know, and it's like separating from community because of the fear of the projected sense that I have something that I can hold that could be taken away, or a little place I've gotten to that I can be banished from again. And usually the redemption in my work, which is a lofty word I don't usually use, is that people stop. And use right. something, life conspires and it builds up too many things. Like Elizabeth in Crooked Little Heart has stayed one step ahead of dealing with the fact that when Rosie was 4 years old, her father died violently.
Mm-hmm.
And she was drunk and Rosie pumped her out of it. And when Rosie was sad, Elizabeth pumped her out of it. And everything that Elizabeth has done has kept this things being kind of homogenized mm-hmm. and kept the pond as calm as it could be. But the price that Elizabeth has paid by the time Crooked Little Heart begins is that she hasn't gotten to find out who she is.
Right.
She hasn't gotten to dance.
Right.
You know, she's kind of like the set designer and the makeup person for everybody else.
Right.
She hasn't gotten out there to just dance and be wet and sweaty and cry and have abandon and blending and being a part of something bigger because she was like this. And if there hadn't been that scary guy, Luther, who's mm-hmm. like this projection of the shadow of death.
Right.
You know, he's evil, scary, funky, he smells bad, and he really has his eye on her little girl. If he hadn't been there leaning on her life, she would have kept on going. But I wanted to push her so hard that she started to crack.
Right. He was the key to the change even in Rosie.
He was the key. Well, he wasn't in Rosie.
No, I mean the Rosie character in
exactly.
Crooked Little Heart.
Exactly. They thought he was the beginning of the end.
Right.
And in a certain sense he was, because he was ending the old illusion they were all caught up in, which is that something had happened and they'd all gotten
right.
on with their life. They
right.
hadn't. Rosie had never laid down and sobbed with her mother because her daddy got snatched
right.
away from her. But, you know, there's that wonderful, who is it? I'm starting to sound like you. No.
You could do worse.
Leonard Cohen. I could do a lot worse. It's that wonderful Leonard Cohen song that says there are cracks in everything.
Mm-hmm.
That's how the light gets in.
Hmm.
You know, and it's a song about transformation. It's a song about if you're English, hypothetically, you get some cracks on the exterior of the vase and you start to spackle like mad. You want to cover up those cracks so that no one can see that there are cracks in your family. There are cracks in your being. There are cracks in your heart. Jesus gets in through the cracks. You know, Holy Spirit gets in through the cracks. My first thought is spackle, paint, caulking mat. We need some caulking stuff, you know. It'll be in a tube what I need. And what Elizabeth finally got to was the point where there were too many cracks and the light started getting in and she started feeling things. And it was every bit as awful as her subconscious had told her it was
mm-hmm.
going to be. And she got there, and she had a friend and a husband and a child who somehow could hold the space for her
mm-hmm.
to break down into those cracks and mm-hmm. then to end there. And then, as it says, you know, to see this mosaic that's come crumbling down and to start picking up the mosaic chips and the tile and to start to know them for the first time. Who
right.
am I? What am I? Where did I spring from?
I know that you don't think much of writers' conferences.
Is this a writers' conference? It isn't, is it?
Not exactly.
Not exactly.
We call it a writers' symposium.
Okay.
That's different. But I know you don't think much of them. And yet, there are a significant number of students who fashion themselves as writers, a number of people in this audience who fashion themselves as writers. Can you give them some advice? Other than the Flannery O'Connor advice, you know, stop what you're doing and go find other work to do. I'd like to hear you give them some advice, even though I know you fear filling them with false hope.
Yes, in fact, that's the reason a symposium sounds to me like people go somewhere and they hear a lot about writing for several days and they talk about it and they ask questions.
Right.
Stuff like that. Okay, I don't have a problem with that.
I'm so relieved.
What I have a problem with is the writing conferences that I get asked to and that I used to do a lot more of, where a lot of other writers and agents and editors are getting a very lovely week at a very beautiful place to fill people with the belief that if they work harder and type their manuscripts just right and master the art of the query letter, that they will probably get to be writers, and that getting to be writers will fill them up and make them well and whole, and that if they become writers, published writers, that the world will validate their parking ticket. Well, none of it's true.
Right.
And what is true is that the writing works. You know, that's the one fly in the ointment, too, is that the writing is the only thing that works. You know, it's the paradox that in that discipline is the only way you find freedom, creative or otherwise, soul freedom, is in the discipline of sitting down and being in a relationship with yourself like you would be with somebody that you really love, another person. Mm-hmm. Where if somebody came to me and said, I love literature so much, I find direction, I find illumination, I find solace, I feel it's a calling to read great literature, and I love to write, and I want to play, I wouldn't say, oh, for God's sake, well, that's ridiculous, you know? You have a job, you have, you know, you're not actually funny, or, you know, I don't think you're that interesting, you know, can I be candid? I wouldn't do that. With a friend, I would say, you know what? I don't think there's anything more important than that you figure out a way, by prearrangement with yourself, to get a little writing done every day.
So it's about writing, it's not about publishing.
Yeah, but it's also, it is about writing, and then I don't think that people should not publish for the sake of not publishing. I don't think there's anything more corrupting about publishing than there is about the rest of the world. But I think it's a lot of false hope that it's the great belief that there's something out there that's really going to do it for you, mm-hmm. you know? And so that I have a lot of students over the years who have banded together, and it's very touching to me, in kind of little writers groups of 3 and 4 people and 5 people, and they meet every Wednesday for coffee, and it's a form of benevolent pressure to because you have to show up with something to read, or pretty soon they don't invite you back. And so you need to bring 3 new pages. There's 4 of you. You're going to read them out loud. There are 5 of you, and you pass them out, and you work on them. And maybe you've gotten 15 pages done, but at the least you've gotten your 3 done. And that's the most important advice I could give you, is that there's the great lie, if you ask me, is that you have to do it alone and suffer, or we can't really count it. You know, and I think that's the American way. And I will not name the gender that came up with it, because that will sound angry. But I don't buy it for a second. And I think that if you can find people who can function as midwives and birth coaches to say, you want to write a book so that your grandchildren will know what it was like for you in Tokyo in 1930, I so entirely support you that I will meet with you every week, and let's give this 3 months and see what it's like. You know, and to avail yourself for their calls when they're not doing well, when they want to give up, and you, because, you know, the Lamont's theorem of creativity is that if you make enough calls, someone somewhere is going to be doing all right, you know? So if there are 5 of you in your writing group, one person's doing fine. They're just writing along. They're not thinking too much about whether it's going to be an Oprah book of the month, you know? And they're just doing it because they can't not do it, is what it boils down to. Okay. And you call that person, the person says, I was going to give up too, you know? And last week, and what I did was, I wrote 300 words. That's my advice. 300 words a day is one type piece of paper without very good margins. And that's one page a day. And my students go, oh, no, I'm quitting my job. I go, please don't quit your job. Please, don't quit your job. They go, no, I'm going to quit my job. I'm going to write for 8 hours a day. I go, don't quit your job. Don't write for 8 hours a day. It's not going to work. It's not going to happen. Write one page a day. No, I'm committed. I'm going to quit my job. You know, I'm a little codependent, and I feel frantic about the family surviving. And then I see them 3 years later. They go, oh, I was in your writing group at Book Passage. I go, oh, how'd your book go? They go, well, I haven't gotten started yet, but my last child is leaving high school, and I'm going to really be able to bear down then. I'm going to be able to write 6-7 hours a day. I go, don't write 6-7 hours a day. Write one page a day. It's 300, taking time off for major holidays and bodily breakdown. It's probably 300 pages a year of sloppy first draft.
That's a good year.
It's a great year.
Anne Lamott, thank you so much for being with us.
You're welcome.